Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, a new study suggests that the powerful feel less empathy. Does that have implications for societies? Then, in light of Scotland's referendum on independence, we'll compare the Scots movement with other movements for secession, autonomy, and independence. Our next guest has conducted a study on empathy, which suggests that power blunts our ability or willingness to feel empathy toward others. With us is Dr. Michael Inslick. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto and the author of Stereotype Threat, Theory, Process, and Application. He's co-author of Power Changes, How the Brain Responds to Others. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Michael Inslick. It's great to have you here. Your study explores power and empathy. I thought it would be important to first explore the importance of empathy.
Maybe I should start by thanking you for having me on your show. So I think empathy is an emotion that allows us to connect to other people. And it allows us to kind of understand what they're going through, what they may be experiencing themselves. In a way, it's, you know, sharing the emotions of someone else, maybe trying to put yourself in the shoes of someone else, and then kind of understanding, you know, where they're at in a sense, what they may be thinking, what they may be experiencing, and what their intentions are. So it's a very, very valuable process that allows us, well, first of all, to maybe reach out and help people. But it also helps us understand, you know, what people are feeling and doing and thinking, and then we can predict how they're going to act, and then we can act in accordance with how they're going to act. So in a way, it allows us to read their minds. And that's a really, really valuable skill to have.
Your study explored power and empathy, essentially finding that powerful people experienced less empathy using the brain's mirror system. So first of all, what is the mirror system and how did you test this in the lab?
The mirror system essentially is a set of brain regions or networks that seem to be activated when a person, let's say, engages in an action, but also when they watch someone else engage in the same action. Now, this may or may not be related to mirror neurons. So this is kind of a famous story of these Italian scientists in the early 90s discovered this class of neurons in macaque monkeys. And more recently, it's been discovered that humans as well have these class of neurons. And these neurons seem, again, to fire when engaging in some sort of motor action, like you're reaching out your hand, for example, but also when observing someone else do that same kind of action. Now, some people have argued, although it is somewhat controversial, that mirror neurons maybe, or maybe more broadly, this kind of mirroring system plays an important role in empathy. Maybe it helps us understand what people are going to do, their intentions, and in a way it allows us to kind of mentally simulate their actions, and as a result to understand those actions and for potentially to maybe change our own behaviors as a result of what we predict they'll do. So that's in a sense what this mirroring system is. And now you also asked how we assessed this in our study. So really what we did is we used a technology called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a powerful electromagnet that we kind of hover it over a person's scalp, and we aim it over certain parts of the scalp, which are right on top of the brain, of course, and we aim it on parts of the brain that are related to motor movements. In our case, we aimed it over parts that would enable a person to, let's say, grasp with their hand. So what we do with this, the transcranial magnetic stimulator, or TMS for short, is it depolarizes certain of these brain areas, these motor brain areas, and as a result, one is able to more readily measure kind of spontaneous motor activity in the hand. So I can actually put electrodes on a person's, let's say, muscles of their hand, the muscles that are involved in grasping. And after I kind of applied this magnet, I'll more readily see this kind of spontaneous firing in the hand. Now, the key here is, we have participants in some conditions, we have them watch a video of a hand squeezing a ball. And the typical result is that after a TMS application, you find facilitation of these motor potentials or of, you know, the of electrical potentials that are responsible for the muscle movement. emits occurs when people are observing a hand relative to when they don't observe a hand. So right there, there's already evidence that people's brains are mentally simulating these hand movements. And you need this kind of electromagnet in a way to kind of prime the brain in a way so you can measure it in the actual hand. Now, for actual study, we took advantage of what we know about TMS and about this motor resonance system, and then we basically evoked different states of power in people by having people write about times in their life when they did or did not experience power. So by power, I mean social power, being responsible for other people, maybe being the boss, making decisions, versus being powerless. You know, you are someone that's responsible for you. You are, you know, a subordinate. You kind of do another person's bidding. And we can all remember times when we've been, you know, in a either high in power or low in power. And then we also had a control group where we kind of just asked people to, write about their favorite season. So something neutral, nothing to do with power. And then we had observed these hand movements as we kind of applied this electromagnet. And then we measured the electrical activity over the muscles that are involved in grasping. And what we found was that people who were, you know, primed to remember a time when they were high in power, they showed a marked decrease in resonance. So they didn't tend to mentally simulate the actions of this disembodied hand relative to people who were either in the neutral control group or especially relative to people in the low power group. The people who were, you know, remember the time when they were low in power, they were especially likely to mentally resonate with others, at least as reflected in muscle activity in the hand.
One thing that I think this also suggests is that this is fluid. It's not static. The people who, when they felt power, but in the next moment you could have asked them to recall something that was a time when they weren't feeling powerful.
That's absolutely correct.
This ability to feel empathy for another or to behave empathically would depend on the circumstance in the moment.
Absolutely. So I hope I made clear in the writing of this article that we're not trying to say something, you know, global or, you know, trait-like about people high or low in power. Because our manipulations, we just took ordinary college students and we had them remember times when they were high or low in power. And they, you know, anyone could have been in any one of those two groups. So you're right. It suggests that this is fluid and that it's maybe not so much an ability or a lack of ability in the case of people who are high in power as it is about motivation. So perhaps if you are high in power, you just, you know, you don't care. You know, you don't care to, you know, mentally simulate the actions of another person because, you know what, I've got the power, I'm responsible, and I'm not reliant necessarily on other people to get what I want. Low in power, even situationally, well, now you rely on other people to maybe get what you want, and as a result, it pays for you to pay closer to what they may be feeling, to what they're doing, so that you can predict what they're going to do and then kind of act accordingly. So absolutely, this is a motivated process.
It's also a little bit reminiscent of another study I remember that suggested positive emotions and negative emotions were incongruent to the extent that when one experiences positive emotions, they can't experience negative emotions simultaneously.
Well, you know, there's probably some debate about that. There's a whole field of research on mixed emotions, so we're feeling ambivalent. So it's possible. I suspect you probably could feel a little bit of both. But I think if you're trying to say that, you know, these are kind of states of mind where you can get yourself into, I think, you know, that's probably right. You know, it's kind of like a willingness to go there. I think that's really what, you know, what we're trying to say with this study.
The changes in the brain are not permanent. They are going to change with each situation.
Unless we're talking about extreme cases, so for example, maybe people who suffer from autism, where some people have argued, you know, one of the symptoms may be a lack of empathy or maybe a lack of ability to empathize. So unless we're talking about extreme cases, I think we all have in our capability an ability to get in the head of someone else. And when we do get in the head of someone else, then, you know, we're doing different things in our minds and our brains. So yeah, changes are, you know, again, are very, very fluid. And really, I think it's really helpful to think of this as, you know, do you feel like empathizing with someone? Are you up for it? Or are you, you know, too busy? So this kind of reminds me of a famous quote by Elie Wiesel, who wrote that, you know, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. So just not caring. When you don't care, you don't engage in those, let's say, the mental operations that you need to get in someone's head and to understand how they're feeling. People, in our study at least, who were primed to be high in power, expect, you know, the downstream consequences of the brain responses are a product of, you know, this indifference, of a lack of willingness, maybe, at least in the moment, to kind of mentally simulate other people's actions.
Another of your studies looked at in-group and out-group biases for empathy. How would you say this fits in with your findings here?
In some other lines of work, we have looked as well at this kind of motor resonance system, a system that is thought, at least by some people, to be really important for understanding people's actions and maybe simulating their actions in your own mind and brain, and really thought to be important potentially in empathy. And what we found was that, and again using this time a different brain technique, this is looking at electroencephalography, so EEG, we found that people's ability to kind of mentally resonate is intact, but it is especially heightened when you're resonating with someone who belongs to, you know, what social psychologists call the in-group. So in this case, it was someone who shared your racial or ethnic background. So if you're white, you are very able or willing to resonate with someone else who's white. If you're black, you're able and willing to resonate with someone else who's black. And we also had Asian groups and South Asian groups from the Indian subcontinent. And we found this, you know, this in-group out-group effect. The key here, though, is that when people looked at people who were from a different group, so when white people looked at black people, or when, let's say, South Asian people looked at white people, or black people for that matter, we found that people were less likely to resonate with other people. So they're less likely to simulate the actions of another person when the other person was of a different racial background than oneself. And we found this to be the case for actions. So when people were kind of in their brain activity, as people were kind of meant, we're assuming having mental activity of resonating with other people who are, you know, doing a simple motor action. We also found it with emotions. So when people observed other people who were, let's say, expressing some kind of distress or sadness, again, people resonated with the sadness. They kind of made themselves a bit of sadness themselves, but typically only when that person belonged to the in-group, and much less so when that person belonged to the out-group. And as well, we also found a relationship between people's attitudes about groups. So their levels of prejudice towards various groups. And we found that levels of prejudice directly predicted the amount of, let's say, motor resonance that you showed in your brain. So the more prejudiced you were, the less you tended to mentally simulate the actions of out-group people. Now, to get back to your question, you asked how this relates to our current study. I mean, I think at this point I would be speculating because we didn't actually measure power in these studies of intergroup relations. But it's conceivable that, you know, there may be power differences between groups. Maybe another way of thinking about it is that the same process may be underlying both things. So again, in our studies with power, I was suggesting that this is a fluid process and that really it's about a willingness or a motivation to, let's say, empathize or to get into the head of someone else. Well, maybe the same thing occurs with in-groups and out-groups. Maybe when I'm watching someone who's an out-group member, who maybe I don't have lots of contact with regularly, maybe I don't really have much exposure to them regularly, and maybe as well if they are, let's say, a stigmatized group, low-status group, well, then I don't necessarily need to, let's say, pay attention to them and to get into their mind, so I'm just not willing to kind of do that, to mentally simulate the actions of these other people. So again, it speaks to a willingness. And we actually have data, it's unpublished at this point, which corroborates this idea of it being a motivated process. So in this study, what we had people do was the same kind of idea, observing in-group members and out-group members doing simple actions. In our typical study, the action is like literally lifting up a glass with water, putting it to your mouth and putting it back down. So in this follow-up study, we actually kind of added an emotional quality to these actions. So we had the neutral one, the glass up and down, but then we also had people, you know, giving a thumbs up, positive kind of maybe a joyous, accepting kind of gesture. And then we also had people giving, you know, videotaped images, people giving you the finger, which is clearly aggressive, antisocial, threatening. And what we found is that, especially for the threatening gestures, that it doesn't matter if a person belongs to your in-group or to your out-group, you are resonating with that person. And that's because now you've got a threat in front of you, and now you're probably motivated to understand what they're going to do, what they're like, because, well, they may attack you. So it pays for you to understand what's going on, what their intentions are. You may pay especially close attention to those kinds of gestures. So this, again, speaks to this kind of idea of this being a fluid, motivated process, and this lack of resonance may be more about a lack of willingness as opposed to a lack of ability.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that empathy can be actively constructed.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I'd use the word constructed, but it certainly can be, let's say, deployed. Some people have argued the ability to kind of mind read in this way is a fundamental ability that a few other animals, if any other animals, really, really possess. So maybe some of our primate relatives may have some rudimentary forms of mentalizing or kind of getting to the heads of their conspecifics. But we have it to an exquisite degree, and it's probably what is one of the ingredients as to why our species is so successful. Some evolutionary psychologists and biologists have argued it's maybe allowed for, you know, the formation of large coalitions of groups. And with groups, you can build societies and cities. So but all this requires, you know, an ability to get into someone's head, to trust them, to understand them. So I think we all have this ability, again, with exceptions, you know, these are going to be based on some diseases or disorders. But we all tend to have this ability, and then it's a question of whether we want to deploy it or not, whether we want to kind of use this thing or not.
Well, Michael Inslicht, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michael Inslicht is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. He's the author of Stereotype Threat, Theory, Process, and Application. He's co-author of Power Changes How the Brain Responds to Other. When we come back, how the Scots referendum on independence compares with other movements calling for independence or autonomy. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. On Thursday, the Scots went to the polls to cast their votes about whether they should separate from Britain and become independent. The development was unique among secessionist movements, many which have involved violence or, in some cases, coercion. We began this discussion with Hurst Hannam. He's a professor of international law at Tufts University. Hurst Hannam is also author of Autonomy, Sovereignty, and Self-Determination, The Accommodation of Conflicting Rights. And he's co-author of International Human Rights, Problems of Law, Policy, and Practice, Negotiating Self-Determination. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Hurst Hannam. It's great to have you back here with us. I'd like to start with the historic context of Scotland and Great Britain. Scotland's been part of Great Britain since 1707. How did that relationship come about, and how has it changed over the years?
As with most unions, I think ultimately it was because of force and conquest. But in fact, both formally and in terms of who ended up with the crown, the formal union of Scotland with England was peaceful, was done by agreement, and in fact the first monarch of the United Kingdom, as it was then called, was from Scotland. So while there were certainly many wars between English and Scots over the centuries, this one ended up being relatively peaceful after those wars were over. Since then, I think there's been a very long and slow history that has gone from a very united kingdom to, in the last decade or so, a somewhat less united kingdom in the sense of what was a relatively highly centralized government has gradually become more and more devolved. From the very beginning, Scotland was able to retain their own legal system, for instance, and they've had a number of powers that were unusual for 200 years ago. But in the last 10 years, since devolution has been occurring in both Scotland and Wales, clearly Scotland has had a much greater degree of autonomy or self-government than is common in many countries. One of the things that we should give the Scots credit for, and the Scottish National Party, who won the election and then called for the referendum, is that the referendum question itself was very simple and very clear. It is simply, should Scotland be an independent country? So this was very much about independence, and particularly in the final weeks of the campaign, the British politicians promised that if the vote was to keep Scotland within the United Kingdom, they would in fact then try to devolve more powers to Scotland. It's clear that Scotland is going to end up with more self-governing powers, whether or not it actually becomes independent.
As I understand it, it already has its own parliament. It does already govern many of its own affairs. How different will this be?
Well, I think that the referendum in Scotland and the independence campaign is unusual for a number of reasons. And one of the most unusual facets is that while Scotland clearly has a culture and a history, and everyone knows the Scots in Scotland, this campaign was not about repression. It was not about identity very much. The platform put forward by the SNP, the Scottish National Party, sounded like a political party platform rather than a rousing call for independence and reasserting our historic identity. It talked primarily about the economy and about politics. Scotland felt that, or at least the pro-independence people in Scotland, felt that they were rich enough to become independent. They were a large enough country. But much of the dissatisfaction was from old-fashioned politics. Scotland is generally more liberal than England. And for a number of years, when the Conservative Party was in power in England, the Conservative Party enjoyed almost no support whatsoever in Scotland. So their first complaint was that they were being governed as part of the United Kingdom by a Conservative government that didn't in any meaningful respect represent them. And related to that was the idea that this Conservative Party was also bringing in more Conservative policies. Scotland in general is much more liberal or progressive than the south of England, at least. And so it was about separation based on the economic feasibility and political dissatisfaction, as opposed to any real complaint that their identity was disappearing or somehow becoming weaker.
Your op-ed piece noted that they were calling for more democracy and a fairer society. That would imply that they're not particularly happy with the level of fairness. Do you have a sense of what that is?
Well, I think that the fairness refers to their own much more liberal, socialist, progressive, whatever you want to call it, view of what the social system in the state should be. Education, for instance, higher education is still free in Scotland, whereas it is not in England. Scotland would like to run its own national health service and make it better than the one in England. And in general, there's just the fairness, I think, refers to what many Scots view as the unfair, increasingly unequal society in the rest of the UK that they feel is being forced upon them by the government in Westminster. So the fairness is also partly in how Scotland feels it's been treated. The economics of the situation are extremely difficult to figure out, and both sides have different economists. But there certainly are some Scots who also feel that given the North Sea oil wealth that they possess, that they are paying more than their fair share to support the rest of the UK. But I think that's very much a contested point.
If we look at the global context of movements for independence or autonomy, this was clearly very peaceful. Most were armed struggles. What do you think accounts for the difference?
Well, I think there are a couple of things, but it's very important to take away one lesson from this, and that is that secessionist movements do not necessarily have to lead to violence. This is one of the few that we can remember, although it was only 20 years ago that a somewhat vaguer but similar referendum took place in Quebec in Canada. And while there had been minor violence, this too was quite peaceful. And there the vote for more sovereignty, as it was phrased, just barely lost. It was about 49% in favor and 50% against. I think the key to peaceful possibilities of secession rest with the underlying factors in the country as a whole. The United Kingdom is a relatively democratic, relatively rights-respecting country. And it's just inconceivable to them, I think, that anyone would go to war over whether or not Scotland or Wales or Northern Ireland wanted to remain involved with the rest of the UK. Countries that are either much less well-governed or simply less able to create a viable state tend to react much more strongly against secessionist movements. And the secessionist movements themselves often start out to be violent, and then the central government reacts in the same way. There are a couple of other important secessionist movements in Europe that are looking very closely at the results in Scotland, two of them in Spain, one in the Basque Country, where there has been a very low level of violence over several decades, but the other in Catalonia, where violence has been essentially absent, and most of those who wish to vote on independence have demonstrated peacefully by turning out hundreds of thousands, if not more, people in the streets. And again, Spain is a relatively democratic country that respects human rights, but its central government has reacted by saying that it's illegal to hold such a referendum in Spain. And so the Catalans are planning to hold their own referendum in November, and we have yet to see whether their insistence on that will lead to greater tensions or even violence, although certainly there's no reason to expect that it will.
Now, you have studied international law on this matter quite a bit. Does international law give us any guidance about these movements for either more autonomy, self-determination, independence, secession? What does it tell us?
The short answer is no, that it doesn't. Most of what international law addresses is the rights or obligations of countries outside to try to influence a particular determination that's going to be made inside a country. And in general, it's not appropriate for outsiders to actively either support an independence or a secessionist movement or to oppose it, although technically they probably can give support to the central government. What's also unusual about the Scottish referendum is they never claimed a right to self-determination, which is the way these self-determination, these secessionist movements usually begin. Rather, they simply said, we have a government that's been democratically elected. It would like to have a referendum on independence. So why don't you let us have it? The fact is that international law does not give any part of a state the right to be independent or the right to claim self-determination. But at the same time, it doesn't prohibit it. So as long as the events occur peacefully, as was in the case of the division of the former Czechoslovakia, for instance, the international law just stays out. And it's only when violence occurs and it's accompanied by intervention on one side or the other, or human rights violations or violations of the laws of war as part of the struggle, then international law really comes in. So in a way, as an international lawyer, I find this a very interesting process, but it's certainly not my task, and I'm happy that it's not, to come in and say, this is what international law allows and this is what international law prohibits.
We talked last time, I think it was March of this year, about Crimea and its move for secession. There have been some new developments there, particularly with Russia moving more forces into Crimea. It's quite a contrast in many ways.
But there's almost nothing that Crimea has in common with Scotland, beginning with the state in which it is situated. Secondly, in the fact that the central government of Ukraine never approved the rather shoddy referendum that was held in Crimea. But most importantly, because the referendum in Crimea, in which they declared, at least in theory, their willingness to be annexed to Russia, took place under Russian occupation. And certainly the introduction of Russian troops into the Crimea voided any sort of democratic legitimacy that they might have had. That doesn't mean that Crimea might not want to join Russia, but certainly the situation is very, very different, and I don't think that the rest of the world will accept the legitimacy of Russia's incorporation of Crimea until there is agreement from Kiev and until there is some expression of the will of the Crimeans that is not being determined by the number of troops that happen to be there at the time. If there is ultimately a settlement, which we're all hoping for in Ukraine, that I think is going to be one of the most difficult issues, because it is probable that Crimea would prefer being part of Russia than being part of Ukraine. It's going to be very difficult to get the central government in Ukraine to admit that that's a possibility. And it will be very difficult to persuade Russia to agree to a truly fair referendum in Crimea that even runs the risk of not voting Russia's way.
One of the other issues pertains to how a country deals with its economics if part of it does secede. I believe this was your op-ed about how England would be fine without Scotland economically. But when you look at places like Spain, should its Basque region secede, Catalonia secede, it may face other economic problems.
I think this raises an interesting ethical issue, really, rather than a moral one or even a political one. Secessionists take all sorts of forms, but many of the secessionist movements in recent decades, have occurred in rich regions that want to leave a state to which they feel they are contributing too much. And the question is, while it's none of the business of outsiders really to weigh in, is that something we want to promote? If the richest region or two of the richest regions leave a state so it in turn becomes much poorer, what happens to the individuals living in the rump state whose cost of living goes down because there isn't any sense of sharing? It's common in every country of the world that the richer regions help support the poorer regions, not in a direct way, but through taxation. And obviously all of them benefit jointly from the existence of the country. As I mentioned in the piece that you just quoted, England, the rest of the UK, is certainly a significantly important country economically, politically, and in every other way. And the withdrawal of Scotland probably would not have a major impact. In Spain, though, there is also a not very serious, I think, secessionist movement in northern Italy, which is the richest part of Italy. I think it's something that outsiders should think about, and we should think of what happens if over the next 30 or 40 years there are 30 or 40 new countries, all of them very rich and most of them rather small, and 30 or 4 countries left behind that are unable to support themselves or to maintain their population. I don't think that would be a step in the right direction, and I think there needs to be a greater argument made, a greater legitimacy for independence movements than simply the argument that we'd like to be rich and no longer support our poorer countrymen.
Hurst Hannum, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Hurst Hannum is a professor of international law at Tufts University. He's the author of Autonomy, Sovereignty, and Self-Determination, The Accommodation of Conflicting Rights, and co-author of International Human Rights, Problems of Law, Policy, Practice, Negotiation, Self-Determination. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're exploring secessions and other movements for independence or autonomy. What self-determination really means, and when and where the principles of self-determination or autonomy apply. With us are three experts. Stephen Fish is a professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley, and author of award-winning books including Democracy Derailed in Russia, The Failure of Open Politics, Democracy from Scratch, Opposition and Regime in the New Russian Revolution, and Post-Communism and the Theory of Democracy. Stefan Wolf also joins us. He is a professor of international security at the University of Birmingham and the author of Ethnic Conflict, Causes, Consequences, Responses, and co-author of Autonomy, Self-Governance, and Conflict Resolution and Disputed Territories, The Transnational Dynamics of Ethnic Conflict Settlement. Hurst Hannum is professor of international law at Tufts University and author of International Human Rights, Problems of Law, Policy, and Practice, and co-author of Negotiating Self-Determination and Autonomy, Sovereignty, and Self-Determination, The Accommodation of Conflicting Rights. Welcome to the Scholars Circle. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Ukraine, Russia, and Crimea. Russia is saying that Crimea's vote is self-determination. The U.S. has said they are coerced. Stephen Fish, you've studied this region. Given what you know, what do you think is going on and whether, in fact, this is an act of self-determination or coercion? What are the lines and what's happening?
It's certainly not an act of self-determination determined as one would normally figure these things out and determine it. Self-determination is usually something that happens through an ordinary process of campaigning and voting. In this case, you have an invasion of a piece of territory in a neighboring country by Russia and a Russian-style referendum being held, which means that the media was basically shut down. Skeptical or oppositional journalists were silenced. We've got public opinion polls going back, you know, a decade or so that show that most Crimeans do want some autonomy for Crimea. But when it comes to whether they would like to be under Russian or Ukrainian tutelage, they're split. A bare majority tends to favor going with Russia. Some favor Ukraine. But this 97% vote in favor of annexation by Russia is absurd. This is clearly not a referendum in which the ballots were counted fairly. It's possible that in a referendum held under normal circumstances, not under circumstances where they were being occupied by a foreign power that wasn't held at gunpoint, that a majority still would vote to join Russia. But the point is, we just can't tell from this referendum.
Hurst Hannum, would you agree?
I think when we are talking about Ukraine and Crimea, it's important to distinguish two very different issues. The first is that of self-determination or secession. Is there any right to it? Should we support it or oppose it? The second is the use of force by Russia, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. On the second, there's no question. It was clearly an illegal invasion. It's an illegal occupation now. One might hearken back to Kosovo and recall that when Kosovo made its declaration of independence in 2008, it was occupied by NATO forces, that it had its referendum over the objections of the recognized government in Belgrade. We thought that was self-determination.
Stefan Wolf.
I've been to Crimea multiple times. I've worked a lot in the post-Soviet region. There is probably a strong likelihood that a majority of the population in Crimea would have favored annexation to Russia or an incorporation into the Russian Federation. But the very fact that the referendum in itself was flawed, that it was not a properly negotiated process either within Crimea or within Ukraine more broadly, simply causes an additional complication here where really it is no longer about self-determination of the people of Crimea or Ukraine for that matter, but it's very much become sort of an issue of geopolitics and international relations more broadly.
Now, how does this compare to other regions? Now, you mentioned Kosovo, so maybe that's one example. Are there other areas in other regions that have had this opportunity or asked for this opportunity and faced something similar? Stefan Wolf, what do you think? You've looked at other regions and done some comparisons.
If we just stay in the post-Soviet region, I mean, there are a number of reasonably similar cases. I mean, we have two separatist regions in Georgia that basically have been, if not annexed by Russia, then certainly put in a position where they are firmly detached from Georgia and have been recognized by a very small number of states. And there, as much as in the Transnistrian region of Moldova and in the Nagorno-Karabakh region, which is disputed between Armenia and Azerbaijan, I think there are very strong feelings of local people that they are simply not happy with the current institutional arrangements. And whether that necessarily is equivalent to either asking for independence or asking for being part of Russia, that I would not necessarily want to claim. But very clearly the issue is that the arrangements that were made in the early 1990s, or rather that were destroyed in the early 1990s, simply were not satisfactory to people. And then we end up with these very protracted long-term conflicts that are neither resolved nor are they necessarily openly violent conflicts. I think from that perspective, there is a specific problem in the sort of post-Soviet region, but in another sense, I also think it is quite similar to other situations that we have seen, obviously, in the Balkans, in the post-Yugoslav period. But we can also go and look at Africa and Asia and the consequences of decolonization, where in a similar way, the wishes of the people were often not considered and was all about great power politics at the time.
I often wonder how much of this is related to how these countries were created post-World War I, World War II, or either the haphazard or the forceful ways that countries were created. Hurst Hunnam?
Well, I think it's important to remember that almost every country in the world was created by force. There are very few boundaries that can be considered to be natural. And I think in many respects, the movements that we've seen, not just since the end of the Cold War, but over the last 50 years, reflect a desire either in countries that are very large or in countries where there are different ethnic, linguistic, religious groups for more control over government. Self-determination doesn't have to mean a desire for independence. It can be simply a desire for a greater degree of self-government. The Catalans and the Basques in Spain, for instance, are home to movements towards independence, even though no one would claim that their identity is in any way being suppressed or repressed. The real problem for outsiders is just how do we respond to these things? Because in every case, the problem is that those who want greater self-government or those who want independence are appealing to outsiders for help. And whether it's the Russian army for the Abkhaz or whether it's the EU for the people in the square of Kiev who complicated the situation, we haven't found a way yet to develop criteria for when states should be allowed to fall apart. It's foolish of us to think that 50 years from now the world will have exactly the same boundaries. And so what we need to do is try to figure out how outsiders should respond to these continuing demands for dissolution.
I would just add that, in fact, most states are not ethnically homogeneous at all. And for that reason, you could look at virtually any country in the world and find some people in some places that, who would like to secede, have their own province, have their own region, become independent, or join a neighboring state. And we see in Africa in particular some pretty pathological consequences of reifying and holding in place indefinitely, regardless of population distribution or movement, these post-colonial boundaries. On the other hand, we still don't know how to adjust them.
These invasions historically have ended in violence, which perhaps is something that we should talk about too. Some of these autonomous movements have engaged violence, some have not. Stefan Wolf.
I think that the Crimean case in many ways is more complex than just the self-determination conflict, in the sense that, of course, there's also the issue of the Russian naval base in Sevastopol. And I think that in one way brings us back to the broader issue of geopolitics and why Crimea is really in many ways quite a unique case. But the other thing that I wanted to point out is also the issue that the boundary issues, the international norm of territorial integrity, is of course one that has been held sacred by states for a variety of different reasons. But there's another norm that I think is equally important, and that's the norm of sovereignty. And you can, on the one hand, spin that around and say there should be no interference whatsoever. But on the other hand, sovereignty is not only a right, it is also a responsibility. And I think in a lot of cases where we do see nonviolent and violent movements of particular segments of the population for self-determination, whether that's more autonomy or independence, states usually have failed in their responsibility to, in a way, accommodate a kind of diversity that might be based in a different ethnicity, different culture, different language, different religion. And I think in a way we need to sort of start at this point before we think about redrawing boundaries and possibly invading other countries, which, I mean, Russia has a track record for, but there are other quite recent precedents, Kosovo among them, where I think it is not too difficult to see the parallel. So I think in that sense, the real question for me as a political scientist always is, well, how can we avoid these potentially very dangerous situations in the first place by putting in place mechanisms that make it actually possible for people of different identities to coexist in a country? They don't necessarily need to love each other, but at least they need to find arrangements in which they can resolve their various disputes in a peaceful and democratic manner.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're exploring secessions and other movements for independence or autonomy. It sounds like everybody is leading down the path in your comments about what kinds of guidelines or procedures do we need for two parts of this. One is if there is a move for either autonomy or some other kind of self-determination governance or to move with another state. And the other is how to integrate and what those procedures should be to integrate in such a way the various ethnic groups or languages or religions, the diversity, in such a way that is fair for all of the people involved. Stefan Wolf.
This is in many ways quite a tricky legal question, both from an international law point of view, but also from a constitutional law point of view. For me, looking at as a political scientist, I think every case is usually very, very specific, and there are different historical trajectories and different perceptions that people have of a situation at any given point in a potential territorial or other dispute. So I think from that perspective, it's not particularly helpful of thinking about sort of clear guidelines of what to do under what conditions. And I mean, the few attempts that have been made in this respect, like, for example, the Lund recommendations of the High Commissioner on National Minorities of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, I mean, it's incredibly vague. It offers some good guidelines, but it's all of a non-binding legal nature in the same way in which we don't have any concrete guidelines about the conditions under which states are allowed to fall apart, if you want. In the same way, I think it's very difficult to come up with general guidelines in terms of constitutional arrangements. And looking, for example, across the Western Balkans, the post-Yugoslav space, I mean, you have an incredible range of very, very different arrangements, sort of from an almost confederal arrangement in Bosnia to a form of decentralization in Macedonia and in Kosovo that, although with completely different labels, accomplishes very similar things. Even though, of course, Bosnia, in the way in which it was set up in 1995 at the Dayton negotiations, has unfortunately become a very, very dysfunctional state. So I think, in a sense, the question from a constitutional law point of view is, how do we balance the demands for both the right of minority groups to be accommodated, to have proper protection of their identity, to have proper mechanisms in place that they can actually live their identity? But on the other hand, we also need functioning states. I mean, we need viable polities, viable democracies, viable market economies that can actually provide a range of public goods to their entire populations without discrimination. And in order to do that, they first of all need to be able to function properly.
Hurst Hunnam, let's bring you back in here. You're the international lawyer. What does international law say? And what is the international community's responsibility?
Well, in short, it says nothing. International law neither recognizes a right of secession under any circumstances, nor does it say that secession is illegal. Secession is, in effect, treated the way civil wars are treated. There have been many who've argued for recognizing what some have called the right to remedial secession. That is, if human rights are violated badly enough and in a discriminatory manner, perhaps we should recognize the rights of those whose rights are being violated to separate from the country. But I think we have to go beyond that, too, because even though people might not have a right to break away, they might still want to. We need to try to find a way of persuading both minorities who wish to secede and majorities who don't want to see their borders changed for any reason whatsoever to look at things much more functionally, much more flexibly. In the days when we have the European Union and many other international arrangements, the state isn't what it used to be. And autonomy or self-governance arrangements should be viewed more favorably by countries. As of the moment, I think the only time that that happens is when the country itself is relatively democratic and rights-respecting. Neither Canada nor Spain nor the United Kingdom want to see their countries fall apart. But it's difficult to think that there would be a wide-scale civil war if Quebec or Catalonia did, in fact, want to separate. And so we need to keep the focus on the rights of the people who are being affected and try to make borders, if we can, although it's not easy, a bit less relevant in the future than they have been in the past.
Stephen Fish.
I agree with what Hirst just said, and I think that we do have some positive examples. For example, the divorce between, oftentimes called the velvet divorce, between the Czech Republic and Slovakia is something that many people thought would be very problematic. You know, how would people living in the Czech lands live with the idea of the loss of Slovakia? And there was a lot of anticipation at the time that this was going to be highly problematic. But politicians and the public in the Czech Republic made the calculation that maybe this would be better for them as well as for Slovaks. And that divorce actually has worked out reasonably well. In fact, I think you could argue that both Czechs and Slovaks are better off living in separate countries, although they, in ethnic and linguistic terms, are really not terribly different from one another. There hadn't been violence across the border of the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Still, that worked reasonably well. The state isn't what it used to be, and especially in Europe, where you've got supranational entities like the EU, where you've got an overarching entity that's bigger than states themselves, it makes, in some way, these separation of territory, secession. One could view the Slovak-Czech thing as less of a divorce than a secession of Slovakia from the Czechoslovakia. It makes it easier. And it also means that the whole justification for the existence of this or that state grows weaker. So take Belgium, for example, right now. A lot of Belgians are asking themselves, well, why should we even have a Belgium? The Flanders, people who live in the Dutch-speaking parts, and Walloons, people living in the French-speaking parts, have long viewed themselves as really not necessarily part of the same country. And if those two countries were to become independent states within the framework of the EU, the folks in both country, in both parts of the country might benefit from that. Now, with Brussels being, of course, the capital of Europe in many ways, and Brussels being a divided city, that might be less likely to happen. But I do think we do see some cases where, you know, some change in international norms that indicates that we might be seeing some progress. Again, as Terce says, though, we see this for the most part in, you know, countries that already have well-established democracies, where rights are already respected, where the rule of law does exist. How this can actually happen in places like Russia or Ukraine or in most African polities, though, is an entirely different question.
Stefan Wolf.
If you look, for example, at the almost velvet divorce that we had between Sudan and South Sudan, I mean, there was a referendum. Everybody agreed that they would accept it. We had the separation of the country in July, now almost 3 years ago. But since then, it's always been completely downhill, both for the process in Sudan and what has happened in South Sudan and what has happened between the two countries. So I think in that sense, there's also a very important lesson here that many, many years earlier, in the early 1990s, we could also see in the case of Ethiopia and Eritrea and their separation. I mean, the separation itself worked quite well, but then they went to war with each other again. So I think the important point here is that separation doesn't resolve anything in itself if it is not very carefully managed. So from that perspective, I would still be much more on the side of those who would say, well, changing boundaries doesn't really help resolve conflicts. I mean, it may terminate one conflict, but at the same time reignite or exacerbate a number of other conflicts. From that perspective, for me, the key issue always remains of how do we manage these processes of trying to find arrangements by which people either can live together or by which they can sort of avoid a very messy and costly divorce. And yes, there are good cases where it has worked reasonably well. I mean, You could even argue that the disintegration of the Soviet Union as a whole in sort of the course of 1990-1991 was not that badly managed a process. It was the aftermath. What then happened in the individual states and what now sort of comes back to haunt us in the case of Crimea and possibly a host of other countries with ethnic Russians and Russian speakers around Russia, where, again, I mean, the point is not so much how you resolve the conflict, but rather sort of what you do to make sure that the whatever resolution is adopted really is sustainable and provides a degree of stability and security.
Hirst Hannum?
Well, thank you. I think I've finally found a point of at least minor disagreement, and that is on this question of boundaries. There were actually minor boundary adjustments when the Czech Republic and Slovakia separated. And one problem is that we still look at the boundaries that come after countries have divided, like Yugoslavia, for instance, as sacrosanct. And they're simply not. It's a complicated and messy process. But I think what we need to do is to recognize that borders that were drawn by a dictator, which is most of the borders in the world today, need not be respected, and that we need to find a way to allow people within new states as well as old states to express themselves through a series of referenda that are not governed by the presence of foreign troops. And if boundaries need to be withdrawn, then let them be withdrawn. We're never going to do it perfectly. We will never live in a world where every ethnic, religious, cultural group has its own state. It's simply impossible. But to keep newly trapped minorities trapped in new states is just as bad as trying to keep existing minorities trapped in old states. And we need to be open to the possibility of shifting boundaries by peaceful means, not by force.
Thank you, Stephen Fish, Stefan Wolf, and Hirst Hannum for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Stephen Fish is a professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley, and author of Democracy Derailed in Russia, The Failure of Open Politics, and Post-Communism and the Theory of Democracy. Stefan Wolf is a professor of international security at the University of Birmingham and the author of Ethnic Conflict, Causes, Consequences, Responses, and co-author of Autonomy, Self-Governance, and Conflict Resolution and Disputed Territories, The Transnational Dynamics of Ethnic Conflict Settlement. Hirst Hannum is professor of international law at Tufts University and author of International Human Rights, Problems of Law, Policy, and Practice, and co-author of Negotiating Self-Determination and Autonomy, Sovereignty, and Self-Determination, The Accommodation of Conflicting Rights. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hirst, Tim Page, and Huatema Gailaman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.